lot will the contract look like this, with two parties exchanging considerations for one another. Whether it be money, services, or goods, or legal detriment, giving up the right to do something that they had a right to do. Regardless of what it is, any of those things will constitute valid legal consideration for a contract. As we get to this chapter, there's a number of new configurations. This is the first one. Third-party beneficiary contract. Just like a two-party contract, there's only two commitments to consideration between the three parties. A obligating himself to B in exchange for B obligating him or herself to C. This is your classic third-party beneficiary contract. In this model, we call C an incidental beneficiary. Why do we call him that? Because C didn't render any consideration to anybody, so he doesn't have contract rights. However, the common law contract said that if A refused to enforce this, C could, but only if A refuses to enforce the contract. Because C is owed consideration from B, certainly the pre-existing duty rule would apply. Any questions so far?
Say A and B had a contract and B subcontract C. Well, A goes under.
That's a different model. That's assignment. We're going to get to that tonight. You can hold on that. That's assignment and delegation. I want to take this so we can all understand it kind of one step at a time. All right. So, here's a very simple example. This is Delta College up here. This is me over here. This is you here. They offer consideration to me. It's not a whole lot. I do this because I like it, basically. They offer consideration to me in exchange for me offering my whole consideration to you. And of course, third-party beneficiaries happen all every day, all over the place. Constantly. That's just the way we have to do business. Now, we're going to change the diagram, and then we're going to change C's legal status. Again, before I do that, please remember that C can only enforce this against B, not against A, because C and A don't have a contract. There's been no rendering of consideration or commitment between C and A. So C can't sue A. Hey, I thought you had a contract with B to provide services to me. What happened? No. Because, see, in this model, it's only an incidental beneficiary.
So the arrow could go back to B.
I'm about to change it here. Sorry. I just want to take it one step at a time, make sure everybody's with me. So again, C can only enforce against B, not against A. Now, listen.
So if A is the college and B is you and C is me, and you fail to show up for class, I come back after you, not Delta?
Well, actually, that's not a good example because you're paying tuition.
Okay.
Let's say you didn't. No tuition. I allowed you to show up free gratis. Then yes, that would be true.
Okay.
The situation you're talking about is a complete triangle. Well, I think Joe over here was getting that. If this happens frequently. C renders consideration to A so that A will go out and find B to provide what C needs in business. Happens all the time. Now, C isn't an incidental beneficiary anymore. C is what the book calls creditor beneficiary. So now, of course, C can enforce it against A or B. And sometimes what you have is this. They have all kinds of different configurations. But whenever you render consideration to somebody in exchange for a commitment that they make, then you can enforce it. But we have an exception. Just get back to the incidental. One other thing to tell you about that. who otherwise would be an incidental beneficiary, can become a creditor beneficiary if his rights are vested, become vested. If so, he can enforce it against either A or B. And when you think that, think of one thing that we talked about, promissory estoppel. That same situation. Promissory estoppel, if she is the one that incurs the legal detriment as a result of it, change of C status from an incidental to a creditor beneficiary, and C can now enforce the contract against either one. How does that happen? C relies. Let's say that A is going to go out and find money for C to start up a business. C believes that A is very credible with his promises. He can't come through for him in the past. And C goes ahead and relies on this promise to provide money for the startup of his business, and goes out and incurs all kinds of contractual obligations, relying on the fact that he's going to get this money to start up his business, and then he never gets it. And now he's got these contracts that he owes money. If you have promissory estoppel, in other words, it was reasonable for C to rely on this promise that this money would come through, then C can enforce it on grounds of promissory estoppel, which isn't really a contract argument. It's kind of an equity argument, if you will, an implied contract argument, but not really contract, because A and C haven't exchanged consideration commitments. Sometimes the book refers to, and I don't want you to get mixed up on your terms here, don't need beneficiary. Means the same for our purposes, it means the same thing. Whether it's a donee or an incidental, it's somebody who doesn't have vested rights to enforce a third party contract that they between two other people that they were the intended beneficiary.
Yeah,
that's half of this chapter. The other half is assignment and delegation, which we'll talk about now unless we've got questions. Somebody mentioned, and I think it was over here, self-contract. A term we're all pretty familiar with. A self-contract is when a party who already entered into a contract tries to get somebody else to perform for them. Rather than rendering the performance that B is owed, because B has paid for the performance, A goes out and finds somebody else to do it. C. Like in a building contract. You know that there's going to be subcontractors, but you don't have a contract with them. When you sign a contract with a builder, it's to have that builder build you the house. Who all is involved, you expect there's going to be other businesses involved. But you don't have a contract with them. The general contractor is a contract with the subs. But it's the general contractor's obligation to build a house, every single aspect of the house. So we have two possible ways to get another party involved. We have assignment of rights, and we have delegations of duties. And which one it is depends upon whether you're on the receiving end of the consideration or the giving end of the consideration. Assignment of rights is the receipt of the benefit of the contract, the property, the money, the services. Delegation of duties is the one that's obligated to perform. We're obligated to deliver the goods, obligated to perform the services. That's the delegation of duties. And we just have a few simple rules on this. this, these are the rules that are involved if there is no provision in a written contract that allows for delegation or assignment. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But we need to have rules in effect in case nobody said anything at the time of entering into the contract in assignment or delegation. Every lease, that residential lease that anybody ever signs, if you use a standard form, there's going to be a provision in there that says whether you can or you can't. And other kinds of contracts usually have provisions in them. But the common law fills in the gaps in case there wasn't anything said. So as far as assignment of rights, the general rule is freely assignable. Why? Because it shouldn't make any difference to you. If you have, you owe somebody some money on a contract, it shouldn't make any difference to you who you have to pay. And there's one situation where assignment of contract rights are not freely assignable. If the assignment that's been given renders it very unreasonably difficult for you to actually comply with the assignment, it's not assignable. You say, you know that money you owe me? I want you to pay my cousin who's in the Marines in Afghanistan by next Tuesday. He needs money. No, that would not be a legally effective assignment. Because how the hell are you going to get that money to him in Afghanistan by next Tuesday? Well, if that's what he said to do and it was not difficult to do, then the assignment would be effective. But if the assignment is really very, very difficult to comply with, or he might say, I want you to pay Joe Jones the money that you owe me. I think he lives over on Jackson Street. He's over on Jackson Street. You can find out where he is. When you do some checking and he isn't on Jackson Street and he isn't anywhere, you can't find him. You don't know who it is you're supposed to pay. And if you don't pay by Tuesday, you've materially breached the contract. That would be an assignment that's not effective. The other end of the stick, delegation of duties, the performance of the labor or the services or the delivery of the goods. The delegator, let's say it's you, you're delegating to somebody else. Hey, go do that landscaping work. Go clean up that work site. I left all that lumber there and stuff, and I left all that trash. Go over and fix that lady's bathroom, whatever the situation is. The delegator remains responsible in case the job is screwed up. So you may think you can delegate, but you really can't. Because remember the pre-existing duty rule, right? The contract was with him. He's got a pre-existing duty to perform the contract. If the bozo that he sends over there to do the work fails to show up or screws it up, then that's a material breach of the contract. And so he's got the obligation to fix it. So the delegator of the duties remains responsible on the contract. This is a problem in these home remodeling contracts. You're not very sophisticated on these things. Maybe what you are is a single mother or a housewife, and you're supposed to take care of all this, and you're not really up on all this stuff. And so you sign an agreement with somebody to come over and do the house remodeling, and you never see this guy. He sends over some college kids or something to do the work, and he isn't even there supervising. If you're going to sign up somebody because they've been recommended to you to do the work, get a written contract, of course, always a written contract, and make it specify that that person must be on the job. If they're going to bring somebody else over there with them, fine, but they got to be there to supervise to make sure the work is done. The other thing you do on these home remodeling contracts is you always put in a time is of the essence provision. Because if you don't put in a time is of the essence provision, they say, oh, I'll get there. I've got 7 or 8 other jobs. I got to finish those up, and then I'll be over. And they're going to be over there in 3 months. If you put a time is of the essence in there, they can't do that. They got to do it forthwith, right?
That doesn't give that contractor a whole lot of opportunity to have multiple jobs going at the same time and multiple crews going.
I know. It's a problem for both ends because it's a juggling act. It just means you've got to communicate. The contractor's got to indicate when they can get to the job, and that probably should be put in the contract. You know, when you're going to start when do you reasonably expect to finish? That should be put in there, that'll solve that problem.
Go ahead, Mike, sorry.
So if you have a time, like you say, 20 days you have to finish, is that considered that time in the essence?
If you put titles in the essence, then it's just a question the judge gets to decide if you can't agree with the other party on whether they think that's reasonable under the circumstances. It depends on how difficult the job is. It depends how much work is involved. Maybe there's some materials that they need they don't have, they're waiting to get them. We're kind of jumping ahead. This titles of the essence thing is really more in the next chapter, but okay. Joe, you have a point? This Joe over here.
It's probably pointless, but can a subcontractor ever turn into the incidental beneficiary?
C on the deal?
Can the general contractor?
No, the subcontractor. Can he be a C in your pyramid there, or your triangle, as far as if the contractor takes off to Bahamas, won't pay on time job, can he go?
And this happens. Okay. Let's use what we've learned in prior chapters to resolve that. What would you call that then if it's obligated? If the subcontractor claims they're entitled to be paid from the owner of the house, what is the legal theory? We've covered this. We apply it in all contracts, right? The owner got the benefit of the work. The owner knew that the services were not rendered gratuitously. The owner knew that the subcontractor wouldn't be there just because he likes them, because he likes Irish people. He's there to be paid. So, and the owner benefited from it. The owner would have had to go out and hire somebody else to do it if that sub walked off. And so the owner can't say, sorry, it's not my responsibility. It's just a different legal theory. With the contractor, that's a regular contract that the general and the sub had. With the owner of the house, it's an implied-in-law contract for unjust enrichment benefiting from the services that were not intended to be rendered gratuitously.
Does that allow them to collect a profit or just to collect the cost of their work, an implied-in-law contract?
It depends on whether it's, and again we're jumping ahead, that's a great question. It depends on whether or not additional monies that were expected to be made as a result of it were reasonably foreseeable. There's that term from tort law coming back to us. Reasonably foreseeable to the owner of the house. Probably not. Not in that scenario. Okay, now, that's rule number one on delegation of duty. Rule number two on delegation of duties is, the more personal the service, the more skilled involved in the service that's provided, the less likely that a delegation of duties would ever be accepted by a court in the event that the parties were to end up in court. A contract to sing. Now, I can sing a little bit. I have sung at weddings, and I was sang in a rock band when I was younger and all this kind of stuff. But if Mick Jagger tried to delegate to me to sing for him at a concert, couldn't do it. People would not be as satisfied with me as they would be with Mick Jagger. They would feel cheated. So it's a highly skilled. You have an architect was hired because they have an international reputation. Designer. Highly skilled work that maybe only one business does in a particular community. You cannot delegate that. It's just absolutely not delegable. And it would be a material breach of contract, that's a term that we're about to learn in the next chapter. That would be a material breach of contract when it happens. You can't do it. Now what happens? Let's say everybody agrees to substitute one party in and one party out. That's what the book calls an ovation. Doesn't have anything to do with Catholic faith. That's an obina, not an ovation. An ovation is when the parties agree that the original party is not responsible at all anymore. He would have been a delegator who's responsible to fix it in the event the person he delegated to, I hate to use these terms, called the delegatee in case they screwed it up. But because both parties agreed to bring the new party in and have the old party not responsible, then all you have is a substitution. They call it an ovation, and you just have a new part. Okay, so back to this model. A and B agreed, basically with an ovation, that's what you have. He just erased A and put the new name up there. If somebody wants to get you to agree to that, and you've got them on the hook for pre-existing duty, I don't recommend that you agree to that. Hold on to them and make sure they're there to fix it in case there's a screw-up. Especially if it's a services contract. What do you have to gain? Unless you're being paid, unless the other party's paying you to allow them to get out and a new party to come in, then you've got consideration rendered for that. But other than that, I wouldn't agree. Where do these novations occur? Landlord-tenant situation. We're going to spend, hopefully we'll have time to do justice to it. Landlord-tenant law in Michigan. You've got a party that has to, got a transfer out of job, out of town, got a new job out of town, has to leave, but they got 6 months left on their lease. And they found somebody to come in and move in and be responsible for the rent until the balance of the lease. And the landlord agreed to it. That's an ovation. Or a land contract situation. I know old standard form land contracts, there's a place on there for assignment. And in a standard form residential lease, you usually have a paragraph in there involving assignment. And what it usually says is that no assignment is effective unless the other party gets notice of it. Assignment or delegation. And they use the term assignment in those forms covering both situations, delegation and assignment. And they use assignment to cover everything, so you've got to be careful about that. And no assignment is effective until the other party has notice. Even if it's not put in the written contract, if all of a sudden the person that you think you have a contract with isn't going to perform and somebody else is, that assignment or delegation is not effective unless you have notice of it. There's a rule on credit transactions, too, on 400-401. When the transaction is based on extending credit, a person to whom credit was extended cannot assign any rights under the contract to another. So you can't assign responsibility for extending credit. That won't be on the test, okay, but... There's that little novation term there on the bottom of page 4. All right, let's do a few problems. Which role would like to start tonight? Do we have a role that volunteers? All right, your role, you're going to volunteer your role. That means when you raise your hand, you start, and we'll go this way. You're off the hook. Okay, you start.
Oh,
so
this one.
At number 3. A nice little one. Never had any trouble volunteering for that little one.
New contract to paint Sally's two-story house for $2,500. Sally realized that she did not have sufficient money, so she transfers the rights under this agreement to her neighbor, Karen, who has a three-story house. Karen notifies Lee that Sally's contract has been reassigned to her and demands that Lee paint Karen's house for $2,500. Is Lee required to do so?
That's an easy one. I don't see that being unreasonably difficult to comply with. It's right there, next door, right?
No way. That's an extra story. He's not going to do that.
Why not?
Because it's not a regular contract. You can't just add that to somebody. You can't just transfer your contract to someone else. And
you're still going to get his $2,500, right?
More work. More paint, more...
That's exactly right. He negotiated a deal for $2,500 for a two-story house, which we can presume is a market price in that business.
That's based on
and so what he shouldn't have to do without an opportunity to renegotiate, he should not obligated to pay $2,500 to paint a three-story house for the same price. Lucas?
Let's assume that the neighbor's house was identical. Would he be obligated to paint the neighbor's house, or could he just cancel the contract?
Practically, he probably won't because you need business. Probably, he'd have to have a reason, or he's not going to be in business very long.
Sure.
They didn't have a reason not to do that, because they need to make money, so I don't see that situation ever happening.
Okay.
Unless there was some reason, maybe there were pit bulls.
They didn't like them. They
didn't like them. Maybe there's pit bulls running around that's not on a leash. Yeah. Probably not going to do it.
Now, when they sign that contract to start with, does it say somewhere that it is signable or it's unsignable?
Or standard form contracts usually have some language in there like that. And they use the term assign to cover both assignment and delegation. So I don't want to get confused on the terms here. Obviously, delegation is the performing of the work. Assignment is assigning to somebody else the right to receive money.
Which he is doing for the next one.
He's trying to make the person do a whole bunch more work for the same price.
Yeah.
And additional costs. As Nick pointed out, additional costs have to have more pain, obviously. Number four.
Assume that Lee agrees to be silent on behalf of being contacted to parent and stated question first. Thereafter, Lee fails to perform the contract to speak to parent house.
Doesn't say whether or not you get the money. You usually don't pay all the money up front, though. Is it half up front and half when it's done usually?
Yeah.
So let's answer it both ways. First, let's assume he did get paid the money. We'll do the easy one first. Is he liable? If he was paid the money up front.
For sure.
Obviously. What about if he was not?
If they're asking his salary file.
Then this would be the what? The equitable remedy of specific performance of contracts. In other words, he'd be going into circuit court and asking the circuit judge to order him to perform this work. What's the problem with that? Can anybody here think of a problem in doing that?
Usually if you order somebody to do work, won't they just like throw it together and leave?
Exactly. It's sort of like in divorce cases, when we used to have water beds. I hope we have a water bed. If you have to go to court to get the water bed in the divorce case, is there going to be a little bit, to force the person to give up the water bed, is there going to be a tiny little hole in that water bed by the time you get it? Same thing. If somebody is only paying the house because a judge ordered them to, not going to be very happy. Doesn't want to be here. Probably going to screw it up. And so that raises a very good point. The specific performance remedy may not be desirable to the party, or maybe the court will be reluctant to order somebody in a specific performance remedy in that situation.
Couldn't you just get the money out of it?
And so what would be a better remedy? Go out and hire another painter. It's not going to try to sabotage the job.
Can you just get the money out of that guy that...
If he paid him, yeah. But that's the second form of the question of what is if he wasn't paid that we're talking about.
So is Sally liable? Sally would be liable if the contract transfer. Why would she be liable?
The only way a party's liable is if they have a contract and didn't perform on the contract.
And she wasn't part of the contract, so it's not close.
That's right. Number five.
Jesse borrowed $1,000 from Thomas and agreed to repay him money in 30 days.
Great stop right there. Is that a contract? No, that's a loan. That's not a contract. Okay, go ahead.
Thomas assigned the right to into Douglas Finance Company. Douglas sued Jesse. Jesse argued that he had years of paying money only to Thomas, and that he and Thomas had entered into the transaction where no one had to the benefit of this funding.
Is that freely assignable, the right to receive money?
Yeah.
Should there be any problem in that assignment?
Yeah.
Laura, I think I'm going to have to apply the too easy rule. I'm applying the too easy rule to that, and I'm going to make you do seven. Is that the first time I've invoked that rule? Well, it needs to get invoked once in a while. Go ahead.
Helen obtained an insurance policy insuring her life and naming her niece Julie as beneficiary. Helen died, and about a year later, the policy was found in her house. When Julie put in the insurance money, the insurer refused to pay on drawing the policy required that notice of death be given to the county following her death. Julie claimed that she was not bound by the time limitation because she would never agree to it, as she was not a party to the insurance contract.
Well, that's an easy one. That insurance company's contract wasn't complied with, they shouldn't have to pay it. that wrong?
No, I don't mind.
Of course I don't. Because if that were the case, insurance companies, anybody here work for an insurance company? Insurance companies believe that they only should receive money in the form of premiums, and they should never have to pay any out. That's how insurance companies make money. That's how they get wealthy. They certainly don't make money paying claims. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm like one of those TV lawyers. I think insurance companies are about the same as the devil. And Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein are all one of the one. I don't view insurance companies that way, like they do. This is, of course, a whole life insurance policy is, of course, a standard third-party beneficiary type contract. Okay. And the insurance company has to pay upon the death. And they're claiming that they weren't given prompt notice, so they shouldn't have to pay.
They say bound by the time limitation. That's what limit? There isn't a time limitation applied.
Actually, there usually is. Why is it that insurance companies put that in the language? There's a reason. The reason for all this stuff.
Hoping they lose contract.
So if that little old lady never tells anybody that she put that transfer.
Anybody got it? They want to be able to investigate the circumstance. Because suicides usually are excluded from payment on life insurance policy. And the sooner you can get a private investigator out on the street investigating after his death, the better chance you have of being able to come up with some evidence. And of course, they would like to be able to have some evidence to justify not paying the premium. And the longer it goes, the harder it is to investigate those things. That's why. If this party was aware, I think that the result is different. If they could prove that this party was aware of the time limitation and just intentionally didn't comply with it. But that's not the case here. There's no suggested fact that they were aware of it. And that I can be bound by it based on these facts. Okay, number 10.
Zoya operated a store in expensive vintage book pure books. The lease required Zoya to maintain liability insurance to protect Zoya and crew. Cadwell entered the store, fell through the trap door, and she then sued Zoya and crew on the theory that she was a third-party beneficiary of the lease requirement to maintain liability insurance. What she said?
This is tort lawsuit, though. This isn't a breach of contract. This isn't a breach of a third-party beneficiary contract lawsuit. It's a tort lawsuit, right? Fell through a trap door and was injured, so they sued. And instead of suing on tort, they tried to claim that they were a third-party beneficiary of the lease. What do you think of that argument? Are they a third-party intended beneficiary? Or is this really just a tort lawsuit that should have been brought in tort? A lawsuit that should have been brought in tort. Which is, whoever is responsible for maintaining the premises was negligent. What?
Isn't any way you enter the store if you're pretty beneficiary? I mean, if you're going to buy something from that person, technically they're being serviced to you under a...
The lease requiring that...
What is a contract? Contract is when something of benefit is intended to be conferred on another party. What kind of benefit was supposed to be conferred on this party? Nothing.
What
this
goes
is
to
avoid a lawsuit in tort. That's the whole purpose of the insurance, was to avoid and was to be able to reimburse and have money to pay in case there was a lawsuit in tort. This person's not an intended beneficiary. If that's the case, you'd have 356 million intended beneficiaries. If any potential human being that might walk in there is an intended beneficiary, it's a negligence lawsuit. And obviously there was either the lawyer was incompetent, brought that suit, or there was a reason why they didn't think they could recover in tort. It could be because they had nobody to sue. In law we call that deep pockets. There were no deep pockets available to file a tort lawsuit for, against whoever was responsible for maintaining the building, and they thought they could tap into that insurance policy. Or maybe instead of being incompetent, they were ingenious and thought that novel theory just might work. Anybody have, somebody else have a hand up?
Yeah. So were they Zoya, or were they just considered a visitor in that building, or a trespasser, or?
Doesn't really indicate. Maybe Caswell was intending to do a breaking and entering with intent to steal. Doesn't really tell you. But we'll assume that they, what kind of building was this? A store. So we'll assume they're a business invitee. And so there's a duty to warn, right? And a duty to fix the problem reasonably before they get there. 11.
Henry was owed $10,000 by Jones Corp in consideration of the many odd jobs performed for him over the years and his nephew Henry. Assigned the $10,000 claim to his nephew Charles. Henry Dark died and his widow claimed that the family was defective, but that the claim was for a criminal estate. She based her assertion on the ground that the tax performance rendered by the nephew was not considered a good time in custody.
Does the past performance have anything to do with anything? Or is that just a red herring they've thrown up there, trying to avoid paying? No, it has nothing to do with it. If the issue is not whether or not this is an implied law contract situation, or this is gratuitous, the issue is this an assignment that rendered performance of the contractual obligation unreasonably difficult? Because all it is assigning the right to receive money. What's so difficult about that? Instead of paying me, because I might die, pay them. Is there anything to indicate here that it was going to be more difficult for Jones Corporation to pay?
No.
Doesn't say he was in the middle of the war in Afghanistan, does it? Doesn't say he's in state prison, does it? I don't know. That's just a red herring argument. By the way, when we do our court cases, I don't mind seeing some red herring arguments. You might feel like the facts are against you on your little case or your problem. Come at it with anything you can come up with. Anything that sounds good. Who knows? Our court might buy it. You never know. And some of these can be argued both ways. We've already seen that. Okay, chapter 19, discharge of contracts. We're not talking about a liquid that's drinking from somebody's lips after they enter into a contract. We're not talking about that kind of a discharge. The discharge we're talking about is when the other party of the contract did something or didn't do something they were supposed to do, which means now that you don't have to continue to perform because you now can consider your obligations discharged. Instead of cancellation and canceled, we're using the term discharge, which means like canceled. So this chapter, at least this part of the chapter, deals with all the different ways you can consider a contract that you've entered into now discharged. So you don't have to do anything further. And the first one we have here is condition precedent. Now they talk about condition subsequent and condition precedent. Forget the precedent and the subsequent. Condition. Just remember condition. A condition to a contract is when the parties agree that until something occurs, we're not obligated to perform. Or, a condition to a contract can be, we agree that if something did happen that we weren't planning on having happen, our obligation to perform is canceled or discharged. So, people in business frequently jump the gun because they just feel like they have to. They jump the gun and enter into contracts before the financing's there. They're going to need. And maybe they enter into a contract before the raw materials arrive at their dock or at their warehouse, expecting them to be there on a certain date and they don't come for lots of different reasons. Problems in shipping, problems in the source of the materials never even got on the truck. for one reason or another. Maybe there was a labor strike. Maybe there was bad weather. Whatever the case may be, we're supposed to perform a contract this date, and we can't because something's missing. That's what a condition is. So if it's clear, and the way you're going to know there's a condition is just by the language that the parties use in their agreement. If it's clear or not, they're only intending this contract to take effect that day if, upon the happening of a certain event, the stuff arrives on time. The bank approves the loan. Sometimes what you have is listing contracts with realtors. I know we had this problem several years back. A whole bunch of people from Dow thought they were going to be transferred to Indianapolis, but it got substantially delayed before they ended up going to Indianapolis, and a lot of them already had contracts to sell their houses and not ready to go to Indianapolis. So you can have a contract to say, I'm only going to sell my house if Dow Chemical Company transfers me to Indianapolis. That's another example of a condition that the parties understand. And that, until the happening of that condition, they're not obligated. So the condition never occurs, or something occurs that the parties agree, if that happens, we're not going to do the contract. That's discharge number one. People go through a whole number all of discharges. So that would discharge any further obligation of either party. Don't worry about concurrent precedent, subsequent, don't worry about all that. If this was law school, I might think to do that first time. The next one's kind of an obvious one. Payment. You paid. Now you're discharged because you're paid. You don't have to do anything else. If all you had to do was pay for the stuff, you paid. But there's an exception. Payment doesn't discharge if you notify the bank you're going to stop payment. Now, some people out in the business world that pull stuff like this, you got to watch out for this. If you can get by with your business without personal checks, get by without personal checks. A certified check is the same as a money order guaranteed for payment. So whether it's debit cards or whether it's certified checks or whether it is money orders, try to get by with those unless cash, like that guy says in the commercial, use cash. Cash is almost as good as money. But personal checks, you run into this problem. I've seen this happen in my law practice over in May. It'll be 29 years under practice law. Some people tender checks. Even it's happened to me for legal services. They get me to do it with something that they wanted me to do, then turn right around and stop paying on the check. Now, those rules, stopping payment, banking rules and stuff, is covered in the business law 2 class. By the way, I've been trying to get the school to offer business law 2 in Midland, because they haven't been doing it, since I taught it last in the fall of 09. And I think they told me that we're going to have business law 2 in winter next year, and I think I'm going to be teaching it. Anybody wants to take business law 2 here in Midland. So all that banking stuff is all part of the business law 2 class. So if this person goes down and stops payment on the check, even though they owe for these goods, obviously they haven't been discharged. As a matter of fact, that may be fraud. You may be able to sue them for fraud for doing that. Discharged by agreement, certainly. But get it in writing. Because you're going to, if in common law, you're going to run into problems with the pre-existing duty rule. What was the consideration that was exchanged to do something different other than what we originally obligated ourselves to do? So, in a written memorandum between the parties, indicate how you've adjusted or canceled the price or the consideration in exchange for neither party continuing further with the agreement. Then you won't have any problem with this being enforced by court. Kind of going in the order that I want to go in, not necessarily the order that they're going in the chapter. This is closely related to accord and satisfaction, but not exactly the same thing. Because in this, by an agreement, if you just tear it up, nobody's going to do anything. Gone. No consideration rendered at all. With an accord and satisfaction, the parties agreed to change something in the contract, but there had to be an adjustment of the price to make this legally enforceable. Otherwise, you're running into the pre-existing duty rules again. Well, since that party was already obligated to do this for this price, he shouldn't be obligated to do anything more unless he's going to get paid more. And the other party can say, shouldn't be obligated to do anything less based on that price. I call this, I've already mentioned Mick Jagger once tonight, I call this the Mick Jagger rule. I can't get no accord and satisfaction. Famous song. Remember that song? My goodness.
Something similar.
Okay, that was their second American release. After, what was the first one? Used to love me, but it's all over now. It's all over now with their first release. I can't get no satisfaction with the second release in America. There's some other terms in here. In this discharge by agreement, they have the term rescission in there. Okay. Rescission is important because it's an equitable remedy that you can go to circuit court for. You can say a mutual rescission is just tearing up the contract, nobody does anything, forget about it. But sometimes you want a rescission, but the other party won't agree to it. And you believe you're entitled to a rescission, but the other party won't agree to it. So you have to go into circuit court and then try to obtain the equitable remedy of rescission. A judge, the condition never occurred, or materials are inferior, whatever the reason is, you don't trust this person anymore, you want to rescind the contract. It's too risky for you to proceed further. This guy's lied to you enough times. Judge, enter an order saying, I'm discharged. That's the equitable remedy of rescission. And we're going to get back to remedies next year. Next one is impossibility. Possibility of performance. There's some talk in the chapter about commercial impracticability. Forget that nonsense. Michigan doesn't go by that rule. I'm not going to make them earn it. Possibility of performance means that we can't do this contract because the stuff never arrived. This would be a situation when the parties weren't smart enough to put language in the contract that talked about conditions. I don't have to perform this contract if the stuff doesn't arrive at my port. You didn't put that in. You just signed the contract. Well, guess what? The stuff didn't arrive at the port. It's not your fault. The contract is objectively impossible to perform. You can't make these things available to the person that ordered them, because you've got to get those raw materials, and then you're doing whatever you're doing with them. You're putting them into some sort of something that you sold somebody else. They can't come get them because you never got the raw materials to get them ready. And it wasn't your fault. Weather conditions. Pirates took over the ship in the sea with all the raw materials. Whatever the reason was, it's possible to perform. Now, this doesn't get somebody off the hook for making a bad deal. That's where we draw the line with this commercial impracticability stuff. just because there's changes in the price in the market.
Geez.
It's not possible for me to continue this contract because I'm not going to make as much profit as I thought I was going to make. The price has changed. It's not a good deal for me anymore. That doesn't make it impossible to perform. That just means you made a bad deal. That just means that you fell victim to changes in the market prices. Very simple things that you got to watch for. People make good deals in business. People make bad deals in business. Some deals you make quite a bit of money on, and some deals not so much. Some deals you break even. Some deals you lose. That's just business. The possibility of performance means not only will I not be able to make any profit at all if you force me to do this now, but if this is going to hurt me bad, it's going to almost put me out of business. It means that I have to assume all the risk of not being able to perform because of something that happened that was not my fault. And so that then you'd be in a position with a circuit judge in equity that's being asked to enforce this contract to a specific performance resolution to benefit another party, put you out of business, or annihilate you. No, because that's not equitable. So he's not going to do that, and the law doesn't require it. Just because it's not a good deal doesn't mean you can claim the possibility of performance. Any question about that?
I have a question on one of those. My mortgage company, I lost my house insurance. So they have to put a no fault so that I don't get no replacement value of anything. I'm just screwed.
Well, them was the beneficiary, not you.
Right. And so I'm trying to get house insurance back. Well, is that pretty much legal as far as...
It's in the contract.
I haven't seen that.
The workers' contract? You don't have
contract? Oh, yeah. I've seen that, but not the, as far as...
There's going to be some language in there that says they can do that. Okay. You go back and read it this year. Discharged by operation of law. Or death or disability, kind of a miscellaneous category. Subject matter of the contract becomes illegal because it has a change of law or maybe some order issued by a judge. Or one of the parties of the contract died. And there's nobody to take over. His sons aren't interested going into that business and taking the business over. Business is going to go out of business. You've got nobody to deal with anymore. That discharges you. For disability, same thing. The person doesn't die, but they become completely unable physically to perform. Operation law also covers a bankruptcy situation. The party that you're expecting to deliver the goods, keep talking about goods, we're almost getting ready to get to the UCC, well, that's all we're going to be talking about. Files bankruptcy, and since they filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy, that's a freeze. That's covered in this law, too. That's a freeze legally on any liability. And so, that discharges you for further performance. Unless the bankruptcy court steps in and says, I'll keep dealing with you, we'll finish this contract, because I can benefit the bankrupt estate by finishing this contract. So that could happen. There is a use of that.
And how does Chapter 11 differ?
Chapter 11 is for businesses that want to take time out, scale down their operations, get leaner and meaner, get back on their feet, and get a schedule for that. Chapter 13 is for consumers, similar to an 11. In which they pay their debts back, or 80% of them over a period of time, pursuant to a schedule. The bankruptcy trustee gets 10% of the monthly payments and the privilege of paying your bills for you. When the law changed in bankruptcy several years ago, I got out of it. I used to do them. A lot of lawyers will do them because they know it's easy to work, easy money. I just can't sit at my desk and be paid for it. It's oars and he's here, but he can't do it. I'll be hopping around somewhere. Okay. You missed a big one. If the party refuses to perform, that's a material breach after this term. You're supposed to get, there's a schedule of your payments. It's a building contract. You have a schedule of payments. There's a schedule of things that are supposed to be done under this building contract. And he didn't do what he was supposed to do by November 1st. He's way behind. And yet, this contract calls for you to make a lump sum payment to him November 15th. You say, well, he materially breached the contract. He didn't come. He's way behind. He didn't do what he was supposed to do on November 1st. I want to consider myself discharged, and I'm not going to make the next payment. Always follow up those things with letters, emails, memorandum. Don't just keep this in your head. Oh, I took Mr. Dunn's plan. I think I have the right to consider the contract discharged now. Send them a letter specifically letting them know what you're relying on legally. Always. Always, always. So a material breach causes discharge. Here, why do we use the word material breach? Because we're not talking about minor items. A couple of odds and ends weren't quite done right. That's not considered a material breach. Because the law favors completion of contracts whenever possible. It's an important or major or substantial part of the contract was not performed when it was supposed to be, or if it was, it was totally screwed up using inferior materials or whatever the situation had.
Like you leaned up, you didn't change the wall in your house and fell through it.
Material breach, considered discharge. Anticipatory repudiation, that's the next big one. I know we're getting close, but let's just take a break after this. Anticipatory repudiation situation. The party is supposed to deliver the stuff on November 1st. They call you ahead of time and tell you they're not coming. We're canceled. And you say, well, but I paid you. Well, we'll send you a check back eventually. We'll get you money. And you say, no. I want you to perform. So when there's anticipatory repudiation, you can consider, you can say, okay, that's fine. You can consider that discharge contract. But you don't have to. Right? You have a choice when there's an anticipatory repudiation. You can say, okay, fine, you're off the book, we're done. Give me my money back. But you can also wait until that date. You can send them a letter demanding that they perform, and wait until November 1st to see if they do before you sue them. Or in advance of that date, file suit for your equitable remedy of specific performance. Or you got another choice, hire somebody else. We call that finding substitute performance.
Before you discharge the other?
No. Inform the other party that you consider them in material breach. You never tell them exactly what you're going to do, what remedies you're going to pursue. I always keep, when they're in breach, you keep them guessing. Just say you're going to take advantage of whatever legal remedies you have available. And so you go out and find somebody else. If it's a higher price, you can sue them for the difference, which is a good lead into the next chapter. That's called compensatory damages, one of our kind of damages.
The book in the next chapter, when it's talking about anticipatory repudiation, also has anticipatory breach. Are you recognizing
them
different?
Thing.
Okay.
Anticipatory repudiation is saying, I'm not coming, I'm not going to go do it. Just let you know this. Why does that party contact you like that? Because they're hoping you're going to let them off the hook and you're going to go out and find somebody else. And not even worry, not even know that you have a right to sue them for the difference in price if you can't get it for the same price. If you can get it for the same price and you don't have any damages, then there's no reason to sue that party.
Is there a reasonable amount when you have to, when they can say, well, that's accept way too much for you to pay for that, you know, we can find six other places that you didn't say, or whatever.
Sometimes it's just for recreation because they think the deal isn't a good one and they're not getting paid enough. And they're using, trying to use that as leverage to get your pay more.
No,
so I tell you what, if you can, we had another job that we're supposed to do, but if you can offer us a little bit more, then we can cancel another job and then we'll still come. Sometimes that happens.
I think what he was trying to ask about thinking the same thing is like, you call me, say, oh, I can't bring the goods, I'm canceling, and I go, all right, and then I open the phone book and say if I was ordering from McDonald's, you know, whatever from McDonald's, to say, and then I turn around and order five-star class of things, say, and sue McDonald's for the difference of price because I can find nobody cheaper. I think that's what he was trying to ask.
Is there like a reasonable amount where you can be, where the other people can say, well, you know what, that was a grossly negligent, you would have 10 times the amount of this job.
Yeah, let us don't bring any tort terms into it, though. The parties have a pre-existing duty to perform under the original contract. If one party calls the other and says, I'm not coming, the other party can consider it discharged, or it can demand that they perform in suit. If you're going to consider it discharged, you send them a letter telling them that you can still consider them responsible for the difference in price, but you are going to get another contractor. You're going to hire a substitute performance, and you're going to hold them responsible if you can't get a good price.
Yeah, but the question is, say, if there's 20 contractors and you get the one that's on the lowest end to help you, and when he doesn't come through and you go around and turn into number one, the most expensive guy, could you sue him for the difference even though there's 18 people in between that has a lower price that you could go to?
But who's gonna know that? Who's going to prove that? The other party would have to come in and find that out and prove that. Otherwise, you're never going to know.
Well,
I don't think most people would do that. Because what you were talking about is running up the other party's damages.
Yeah.
To stick them, but that's also running up your costs. Because, yeah, then you can turn around and sue them, and now you got lawyer's fees, and then you get a judgment against them, but what if they don't pay and you're chasing them? I think most people wouldn't do that. That's a good question, though.
If you do plan on suing them, and right before you, if you like to write letters on time or email them a fax, you know, what's the safest way legally? You know they're going to deny that you ever contact them. So when you go to court, what's the best way? Fax, email? Can you go on legally? Can the judge go back and get on the computer as far as proving that you emailed them?
As long as you bring proof of what you sent it for.
Make copy, your own copy.
You've got to bring proof of what you sent it for. What you got to make sure you do is don't create an ambiguous situation. Don't lead them to believe that they can still come and perform because you've rejected their insistence for repudiation, unless that's what you want. Because what you don't want is two parties showing up on the same day for the same work. Because you created an ambiguous message to them, and they felt, I came, Your Honor, because I don't want to get sued, and I understand he rejected my insistence for repudiation, and I understand I have the pre-existing duty to come and perform. So I came, and he wouldn't let me perform. So that's a material breach. Again, he wouldn't let me perform the duties that I have a contract to perform. So don't ever create the ambiguous situation. Make sure they know. You don't tell them everything, every legal remedy you're going to pursue, but you got to make sure they understand that whether they will or will not be allowed to show up on that day to do the work. That's what you got to tell them.
You can't just call them on the phone and say, hey, I want
never to do anything on the phone, folks. Never. Unless you're going to follow up with an email or a memorandum. But if we just had a phone conversation, and here's what we just agreed upon with the phone. Here's
right.
What I just told you. Always. Right. Because you got a lot of people out in the marketplace that are just weasels. They'll weasel their way out of any situation and come up with any excuse at all as to why they shouldn't have to pay you for the contract. Okay, we'll take a break.